Hello, and welcome back to Energy Transition Today. I'm Oliver.
I'm Dila.
I'm Maya.
And we're here to bring you, once again, the latest analysis and news from the energy transition. What have we got today? It's quite transport-heavy news today. We've got some EV stories that Maya's going to be catching us up on. And following on from EVs, we'll be bringing you some in-depth analysis on the different types of battery technology which are emerging alongside lithium-ion. We'll also be digging into a bit of sustainable aviation later on in the show and rounding off with some very positive news on the traditional renewables front. But to kick off today, Maya, what has been interesting you in the news of the last week?
Well, we have seen a steady uptick in EV deals, which is something because the sector seemed to have stalled over the past 2 years. Couple of stories from the last week. Macquarie Capital joined forces with Italian fuel distributor IP to roll out a network of ultra-fast chargers at IP's forecourts in Italy. The initial rollout is estimated to cost around $200 million. And interestingly, the debt for this was arranged by 11 banks. So there is interest in this sector, but also some of these banks, MUFG, ICBC, Credit Ag, large banks coming in for 10 mil or less for a deal. So I think commercial banks are slowly dipping their toes into this sector, but institutional investors still say that it's not mature enough for them to get involved. But the Macquarie deal, all going well. They should complete the rollout in 2032. And there is potential for them to expand their partnership to include IP's other forecourts around Italy.
Certainly interesting and a good point about the commercial banks. I think that this is probably going to be one of those deals which your more institutional investors will be keeping an eye on, even if it's not quite for them yet.
That's interesting because over the past couple of weeks, we've spoken to a few institutional investors, and the sentiment on EV infrastructure doesn't appear to have changed. So everyone agrees that there is a need for this, but the demand risk and the sustainability of usage is way too unpredictable for them to get involved, I suppose. And you can't see the likes of I won't name any, but you can't see institutional investors coming in for a 10 million ticket, do you? Like, it's not worth their time.
No.
It's not worth the admin effort for them.
It seems like the complete adoption of electric vehicles is still something which is, you know, it's incredibly speculative how fast that will grow. Actually, Dila will come on, I think you'll come on to talk about some of the potential solutions for that we're on the battery technology front in just a minute. But before we get to that, I think there's more EV stories that we want to cover.
This is EV adjacent. It is EV, but it's zero emissions transport. Rockrail, a very prominent rolling stock owner and operator, has joined forces with Aviva Capital Partners to form a new outfit, Rock Road, which will buy and lease zero emission buses in the UK. This is an interesting one because when you say zero emissions, we have the EV buses like we've seen with Zenobi, who has been active in this space in the UK and in New Zealand. But zero emissions could potentially also include hydrogen buses when that technology finally takes off. But Rock Roads initially is going to be electric buses and associated infrastructure.
So what kind of value do we see on this deal?
Again, following from the Macquarie deal, the deal value is not that big, actually, just 100 million. Interestingly, the debt on this was provided by HSBC and UKIB, or UKIB, as they like to be called. UKIB came in for 50 million, so there's not much left to go around, is there?
Mm.
So when you account for the equity from the two partners, Aviva and Rockrail, there's not much left for commercial banks to take.
So yeah, HSBC's sort of ticket value on this is probably actually quite similar to the individual banks that took part in the Italian deal.
Exactly. Again, these banks, they want to participate in this sector and they see growth there, but I don't think they're just comfortable enough yet to come in for substantial amounts.
Thank you, Maya. We'll come back to some more news in a moment. But as mentioned, Dila, you have been digging into the world of electric vehicle batteries and batteries specifically on the technology front in this last week. Can you bring us up to speed on what you found?
Yes, definitely. So specifically what I looked into was how some of the alternatives are emerging in trying to replace lithium-ion batteries that are mostly found. I mean, you have that basically in little electronic devices such as your mobile phones, but also in EV batteries and also in larger scale battery storage projects.
So lithium-ion is so dominant in the market right now, but there are drawbacks to the lithium-ion battery model, which these other technologies are exploiting. Can you talk us through some of those differences?
Yeah, definitely. So despite them being the most widely used composition for batteries at the moment, it does have a few disadvantages that do sort of make it quite difficult to rely on them exclusively. So the main issues around these batteries is their degree of degradation they experience over time, and that sort of reduces and limits their capacity to store the energy as effectively and consistently the more charge and discharge cycles they go through. There's also issues around sourcing and the recycling of these batteries as well, which obviously attracts a lot of criticism when it comes to sustainability and ethical sourcing standards. And obviously, as companies are more concerned with ESG, and that's being included into sort of company operations, those sort of aspects do draw more attention. There's still a shortage going on of lithium, which is one of the reasons why alternative compositions are currently being examined. There's also one quite critical issue with lithium-ion batteries, which is the overcharging and overheating, which makes them quite flammable batteries. And even though those accidents that have happened in the past, the causes for those fires have been identified and addressed, such as sort of poor installation practices have been mainly causing them. There are still some public safety concerns surrounding this battery composition particularly.
There's also the problem of thermal runaway, which makes fires caused by lithium-ion batteries very challenging to put out.
Yes, precisely. When a fire begins, the reaction is self-sustaining and going and going and going. So these sort of safety concerns have been in the public consciousness for a long time. I suppose people have kind of got used to that risk, but every now and again, there's always a story in the press about, you know, an e-scooter blowing up at a railway station.
Oh, there was yesterday. There was one.
That's definitely exactly right. So all these issues have led the industry to examine and sort of explore alternatives to this specific battery composition. And one of the ones that have emerged as the most prominent players or sort of compositions is the solid state battery. All of these batteries, the internal sort of constituents of these batteries will also all have sort of lithium as a key factor in all of them, but they'll just be differently organized. So the solid state battery in particular, these rely on a solid electrolyte as opposed to liquid or gel electrolytes, and they're composed of materials such as ceramic, glass, and solid polymer and sulfides. So the benefits these batteries specifically can offer are that they have a much greater energy density. They're lending, for example, EV batteries a much greater range, and also have less of those safety issues that are associated with lithium-ion, which is obviously quite critical when it comes to EVs in particular. There's also some estimates that say that they can recharge up to 7 times more throughout their lifetime, meaning sort of, again, that charge-discharge cycle I was mentioning earlier. So these solid-state batteries would be able to do that up to 7 times more without compromising the battery's overall health as much. And they can also charge much faster without the overall risk to cause major damage to the battery. Companies like BMW and Toyota have been seriously considering this battery as an alternative to install in their EVs. However, they have already sort of experienced some of the challenges around this technology. For example, BMW was looking to introduce a demonstrator vehicle before 2025, but that's now been pushed back towards 2030.
Okay, interesting. So it does certainly seem like there are some challenges that come along with this technology.
Yes, that's right.
Infancy aside.
Yes, yeah. Some of the challenges here you will really encounter, like once you start looking into this, it's sort of the scaling of this is quite difficult. Sort of setting up supply chains for batteries already requires extremely sophisticated supply chain links that take time to cultivate and build. You cannot really risk contamination within any of these components that go into the battery. So these battery supply chains really need to be set up quite delicately and meticulously.
And I suppose at scale, competing with the lithium-ion batteries at the moment, when they are so well established, is going to be difficult for any kind of new emerging technology. But that is a technology which I think builds off lithium-ion, the solid state. There are also some just alternative construction, alternative materials, but are being explored, I think, as well.
So the other battery that is sort of slightly further away from that lithium-ion composition would be sodium-ion batteries. So here, this is also a promising alternative. And here, you leverage sodium compounds, which are significantly more abundant than lithium. So that would potentially ease some of the supply constraints. The manufacturing of these batteries would be relying on soda ash, which is a plentiful and sustainable sodium precursor that can also introduce greater resiliency to the resource availability, which you don't really have with lithium. You can also produce these synthetically. So again, just much greater availability without being exposed as much to sort of the markets when it comes to these components. Yes, so some of the other benefits include they have much higher degrees of safety. So the operating temperature as well as its stability overall. It is also introducing benefits such as faster charging and also, again, longer lifespans. However, as I'm sure you already expected this to be the case, there's some challenges here as well. These batteries are both bulkier and heavier than lithium-ion batteries, so that doesn't make them very suitable to put into EVs, for example. However, they would sort of lend themselves a bit more seamlessly for grid-scale batteries. The achieving the economies of scale within this technology will be critical, and the supply chain issues continue to be an issue here as well. So I guess it might be worth just quickly addressing some of the challenges around developing these batteries overall. So I think you already mentioned that the supply chain setting up already alongside an established lithium-ion supply chain is very tricky. And obviously, the battery manufacturing industry is also associated quite sort of intimately with high energy costs as well. So that makes it a bit trickier to introduce some innovation here, and also sort of concerns around the carbon footprints of the production lines. There's a supply crunch of critical raw minerals, and there is serious concern around recycling infrastructure, which is definitely sort of in great need of maturing as well. And some of the macroeconomic uncertainties that have led to underinvestment are also starting to affect some of the electrification efforts. So it continues to be important that sort of companies and countries continue to investigate and invest in this, because obviously the more you diversify and begin to tailor towards specific technologies, they'll just be working much more effectively and efficiently towards achieving the results you're looking for. Having sort of a limit on your dependence on a single material will only be beneficial in the long run as well. One of the people I spoke to for this article said it best. He said, "The battery technology is the alchemy to meeting net zero targets." So we can't really afford not focusing on this, and it will be the lifeblood towards operating and generating the electricity we so dearly need.
Thank you very much for that, Dila.
So Oliver, you have been looking at a similar issue, actually, when it comes to alternatives, but you've been looking into the air. What's going on there?
Yes, that's right. So this week we put out an analysis on aviation fuel, sustainable aviation fuel, SAF as it's known. Well, there are a few reasons, but this is becoming more and more into focus now. For actually similar reasons to why you were talking about people looking for alternatives to lithium ion, one of the limitations of the electrification of transport is that it tends to work best at small scales. But what I mean by that is that lithium batteries work best in your kind of lightweight, less heavy industry kind of applications, where, you know, small personal cars are kind of near the upper limit of what that technology can do. When you start asking about, okay, can we get planes running on battery technology, the calculations for the amount of energy that you need there become absolutely ridiculous. You'd need huge batteries that weigh far too much to make that even work.
And I believe the charging infrastructure is also lacking up there.
In the sky.
In the sky.
Yep.
It's not quite there yet.
You run out.
Recharging between London and New York is an issue.
Oh, whoops. Yeah.
Yeah. So sustainable aviation fuel then is kind of it's a description of the solution rather than the solution itself, because what we need to make the aviation sector go green is we essentially need a fuel that can do what aviation fuel today can do. We need high energy density. We need it to be safe, handleable, and we need to be able to produce it, crucially, through a net zero process. So even if it does burn in jet engines, then it needs to have come from a place of carbon capture to achieve that net zero effect as the industry is aiming for. Sustainable aviation fuels can reduce carbon emissions by up to 80% using the techniques that are being discussed and explored right now. And this is crucial for this aviation sector to get towards those net zero targets. So, for example, the European Union has been kind of at the forefront of pushing for sustainable aviation fuels as part of its Fit for 55 package. There was the Refuel EU Aviation Initiative. This is a proposal which would mandate for increasing SAF levels and blending it into existing jet fuels to reduce the overall carbon footprint of the industry.
So, Oliver, what exactly does SAF constitute?
Good question. So there are a few different routes that you can take to approach net zero fuels. So these all broadly fall under the category of synthetic fuels. So fuels that are sort of constructed via industrial processes. There are several initiatives that are looking into using biomass and energy from waste to process fuel from waste in a sustainable way. And this is perhaps tenable. We've seen a huge increase in the number of biofuel projects that are being tracked by Inspiratio over the last few years. Just looking at the numbers before we came in here, I saw that there was more than a 300% rise in the level of deal activity of biofuel projects comparing 2022 to 2023. So this is definitely a sector that's expanding very fast. Most of that activity is concentrated in the US, a fair bit in the UK and Italy as well, quite far down that track. Another route for producing these synthetic fuels is using hydrogen. Hydrogen is a key component of jet fuel. There's a process called the Fischer-Tropsch process, which can combine hydrogen with various other carbon products to produce something very close to processed jet fuel. Because, of course, jet fuel isn't naturally occurring. That's also something you need to process from carbon products. Only that traditionally comes from natural gas, oil, rather than waste and green hydrogen. It's the same kind of processes that you would use, but a more roundabout and, at the moment, significantly less cost-effective route to produce these fuels.
How close are we to taking a guilt-free trip to New York?
A fair way away, if I tell you the truth, Maya. There's quite a bit of pessimism in the industry about aviation's ability to actually get anywhere near its targets. The former CEO of Amsterdam's Schiphol Airport was quoted last week as saying that he thinks it's extremely unlikely without some fundamental paradigm shifts in the way that aviation is run. However, there are some positive moves. So, for example, we've been covering a few of these stories recently. Simply Blue have announced an initiative to develop SAF manufacturing facilities co-located with renewable assets. And this represents a significant step forward if it were to go ahead. These plants are looking at producing more than 1.5 million tons of sustainable biomass annually, from which could be derived around 300,000 tons of sustainable aviation fuel. Nowhere near enough to run the industry, but a step in potentially the right direction. There's also been some developments from the likes of Solarig, who are in the process of developing the Numancia SAF plant in Spain. Again, integrating renewable energy generation with SAF production through that sort of green hydrogen electrolytic route to make the synthetic fuels. And there's also been a bit of funding activity on this, on the investment side in the SAF space. Macquarie committed to investing up to 175 billion euros in the Sky NRG project towards the end of last year. That's a Dutch SAF platform. And we've also seen moves from the industry itself, Airbus and Qantas, came together last year to unveil a joint investment, equity investment of $200 million aimed at nurturing a sustainable fuels sector in Australia. So there are some moves in this direction. I'm going to say it's probably even further off than those battery technologies we were talking about earlier. But there are definitely reasons to be interested in that. And just a little extra note on this, if you want to read more about biofuels, synthetic fuels, and SAF in particular, Inspiration did a Q&A with the CEO of Kurgan Capital, who spoke about that recently. So you can find that on the Inspiration website.
It's actually quite interesting just from this topic alone. You can see how interconnected all these technologies are with each other, actually. So if you need a whole network of different technologies operating together, you need the carbon capture, biomass, the hydrogen, the renewable energies, everything.
And the whole reason it's necessary is because of those limitations of batteries that we started on. So it is literally everything.
Yeah.
We're actually seeing a lot of this with renewable energy developers actually looking for alternative uses of the energy that their projects produce, because obviously this is, we're not breaking news here, grid connection agreements both here in mainland Europe, they've been quite challenging and many projects have been delayed, and some large-scale offshore developers like Simply Blue have had to come up with alternative uses of their project, the output of their projects, or risk delaying them indefinitely.
Yes, precisely. And a very good point, actually. If you have these projects which can't export their energy as electricity, they're going to look for those alternative routes. And it's sort of natural to look for the biggest off-takers you can. And aviation is now looking like one of those industries which is lagging behind on the renewable front. And we did a few pieces last week, actually, that relate to this, including some of the efforts that are happening, particularly in the UK and Germany, around grid infrastructure investments. And we also had a piece last week diving into the importance of interconnectors and interconnecting these different markets so that not just on the project scale, but on a sort of broader whole grid scale can alleviate those pressures and create a more efficient energy system overall. But that's not all that Inspiration have been up to in the last week. We've also had actually some breaking news coming hot across the Inspiration news desk. Maya, what have you got for us?
Data centres, actually, this digital infrastructure in particular, has been front and centre of late. And a 200 megawatt data centre facility in Ireland was consented after nearly 3 years' delay. Amazon Web Services appears to be in pole position to take over operation of this project, but this is conditional upon the project meeting certain criteria. But all goes well, fingers crossed. The project has a estimated capital cost of 1.2 billion euro, most of which I'd imagine would be equity financed by AWS. And construction works on the facility is set to commence as early as Q4 this year.
Yeah, I think this kind of comes into something that we've talked about quite a lot, which is these big tech players are just hungry for data center use. Particularly Amazon Web Services, upon whom so much of the cloud computing that we use every day relies upon. For these players, they just are constantly looking for opportunities to expand their data center capacity.
They are looking for opportunities, and in Europe especially, there's been a bit of controversy around the location of data centers. So in the past, we've seen these facilities sort of grouped around cities and other major population centres. But the problem with that is the grid load. So you have these facilities that take up so much energy, which causes disruption to the local grid when you have energy spikes. So countries across Europe are looking at ways to mitigate this. And facilities such as this, it's in Ennis, County Clare. So outside of the major population centres with good enough connectivity where the end users will not necessarily notice a difference. Actually, this is one area, digital infrastructure, which includes data centres and fibre connections, that institutional investors are quite keen on. So the conservative players in the market see this as a next big avenue for them to deploy capital in.
That's certainly interesting. And it actually, that just what you say there reminds me of what we've come across a lot when covering the REMA process, for example, in the UK, where we're looking at that regional pricing model. And it strikes me that projects like this in the UK in the future might choose to distribute in a similar way. So we could see Scotland, for example, as the next big location for huge load centres like these. Yeah, that's a fascinating piece. So we've spent a lot of this episode talking about basically everything but renewables. We've been skating around the topic of renewables, but Maya, you did do a deep dive piece about some market trends recently on the Australian market, I think.
It's the state of traditional renewables, I suppose. So your solar, onshore wind and battery storage. So lately there's been a lot of turbulence in the offshore sector. But very interestingly, this has not translated to the traditional renewable sector. So Neoen's latest debt facility is a prime example of this trend, actually. What the French developer did was consolidate debt on, what, seven projects in a $1.1 billion deal. But the interesting part with this deal is the assets within this portfolio have differing risk profiles. I mean, as you know, a solar asset doesn't have the same risk profile as a wind asset, which doesn't have the same risk profile as a battery storage project. Yet they were able to consolidate the debt on these projects, which were previously financed on a standalone basis, not only to get better terms, but also secure a good chunk, around $400 million, in a CapEx facility to fund pipeline projects. What's also notable about this transaction is it was initiated and wrapped up in a fairly quick manner for a deal that can be considered to be quite novel in this market.
So, Maya, what was the attitude of lenders in this deal then?
From everything we can tell, everyone involved in this deal were so comfortable with the profile that some of the lenders on primary financing decided to stay on the refi plus capex. So it's certainly, I mean, I think this showcases the resilience of these assets, which have, I think, become as bankable as any road or bridge you can think of.
Is this something which you think is it notable that this happened in the Australian market, or is this something which could have happened anywhere?
The Australian market historically has dodged every recession that we can think of, but it's not immune to market fluctuations. So you can maybe infer that the environment there is a bit more friendly, but Europe is no exception with these kind of projects. We've seen solar projects, battery projects. They are routinely financed and constructed in a timely manner. But I think with these technologies, we've come to a point where lenders don't give it a second look. They've become quite comfortable with the risk profile and the returns on these assets. So it's become as bankable as anything, I suppose.
Renewables are now core infrastructure.
Yes, some are.
Yes, quite. Thank you very much for that, Maya. We are coming to the end of another episode of Energy Transition Today. Just a few points to bring up before we go. This week, we have opened our submissions for our 2024 European Energy Transition Awards. Now, the submission deadline is the 4th of May. Any deal that was financed between the 1st of April 2023 and the 31st of March 2024, in other words, the financial year, is eligible for an award. There are several new categories that we've opened this year. Can you believe it? Last year, we didn't have a best developer category. But we have one now. We have best developers in renewables, new technologies. We have several new categories for funds that are taking part in the market on the company level. We've also opened up a few extra categories for deal-specific, sector-specific awards, as well as one or two for individuals that have made a difference in the market. We will link to the submission page in the episode descriptions. If you think that there is something that is worth an accolade in the market, then let us know, and a panel of independent judges will let you know if you're right. We're also getting very close to our next industry event in Madrid, 16th of May, financing European renewables. Maya, you're going to be there.
Yes, I am. This should be an interesting one. Very timely event to discuss all things renewables.
Yes. Again, I'll put some details below if you are interested in joining us in Madrid. But that is it for this episode. We'll be back with more news and analysis next week. Until then, goodbye.